1 Samuel 26 is David's raid on Camp Saul. And this may be a forerunner of that raid on Entebbe. It was a raid by Israeli special forces on Entebbe Airport in Uganda in the year 1976. A flight from Tel Aviv en route to Paris was hijacked by PLO Palestinian terrorists, and they diverted that flight to Uganda, to Entebbe, the country's largest airport. There were 106 hostages, 94 Israelis, and 12 flight crew from Air France. The Israelis launched Operation Thunderbolt. It took a week to plan and 90 minutes to carry out. They flew 100 commandos 2,500 kilometers from Israel to Uganda. They swooped into the airport and they released 103 of the 106 hostages. Three somehow did not make it. One commander of the unit died in the rescue mission. His name was Jonathan Netanyahu, the elder brother of the present president, Benjamin Netanyahu, and he lost his life in the attempt. But they did fly out, all those that were rescued to safety. Now, such was the success of that Operation Thunderbolt that the Mossad, the name of the intelligence corps of the Israeli counterintelligence or counter-terrorist squad, they became revered and hated. And as you may know, it is the most secret of all the agencies of Israel to this day. I think that it would be very likely that if David was alive today, that he would be recruited to be taken into the Mossad because of the success of his mission as he invaded Saul's camp under the cover of darkness at night. David and Abishai, they had nerves of steel to steal into the camp in the midst of darkness and go right over the very men that were guarding King Saul, and there was quite a number of them. You'll read in verse 5 that David arose and came to the place where Paul had pitched. And David beheld the place where Saul lay. And Abner, the son of Ner, the captain of his host, and Saul lay in the trench, and the people pitched round about him. Now that was a lot of protectors because Saul had an army of 3,000 men. And so, to reach Saul in the inner circle, they had to make their way through that circle of army that were asleep, go right into Saul's bed, snatch his spear and his cruse of water, and thankfully God was on their side. Because you will read down in verse 12, because a deep sleep from the Lord was fallen upon them. What a great thing to have God on your side. And this is a little window into the fact that now God is on David's side and he's working against King Saul. Now here in this raid that he made upon Saul and was able to take his spear and take his cruse of water from his bolster or his pillow where he was sound asleep was another opportunity for David to take the life of King Saul. He was called by Abishai to seize the moment, take this opportunity, and slay Saul right there. But David did not use that opportunity. And here is a moment when David's character was severely tested. Would he be consistent with his previous convictions? Because this is so akin to that opportunity that he had on the night whenever Saul came into the cave and David could have there taken his life, but didn't. And later held up that piece of his robe and said, "Saul, I'm not your enemy. I'm your friend. I'm your loyal subject." And yet Saul betrayed that very discussion they had and was moved by his incensed counselors to repeat the hunt, the search to kill David. And here is the moment when David is greatly tried, and he must be consistent with his convictions. Now, there are many signs that he should have slain Saul at this event. He knew that Saul was on his way out. He knew that God had rejected him from being the king. He also was now being ceaselessly hunted by Saul. He had not remained true to any former undertakings. He had gone back on his former arrangement when David showed mercy to him. And now Saul was being ill-advised by his counselors, and there's a couple of indicators that there were men poisoning Saul's mind with the wrong information about David. If you go back to chapter 24:9, you will see how we learned that last time. David said to Saul, "Wherefore hearest thou men's words, saying, Behold, David seeketh thy hurt." And so there were men around Saul that were giving him false information. And in chapter 26, verse 19, it's repeated again. And we're told near the end or the middle of verse 19, "But if they be the children of men, cursed be they before the Lord, for they have driven me out this day from abiding in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, Go and serve other gods." And so these are indicators that Saul was being poisoned by his counselors around him. And this madness that was in Saul's heart to hunt down David was the result of the wicked men that were around him. If we may pause just a moment, it is very important that we as Christians get good people to guide us. There's one thing that's going to make or break your Christian life, and that is the friends you make or the people that influence you with their opinions and their notions and their doctrines. And if you get into the company of those that are compromisers, they will wear you down. If you get into the company of those that are carnal and serve the world, they will seek to lure you to their lower standard. The Bible tells us that in the multitude of counselors is safety. And by the way, that is the motto of the Mossad, the intelligence agency of Israel. In the multitude of counselors is safety. Now let's have a listen to David's counsel at this decisive moment in the darkness as they stood over Saul's bed while all around them were sound asleep. And David had that spear in his hand. And Abishai was saying to him, "Now, David." Look at verse 8 and you will see David's response. Abishai said to David, "God hath delivered thine enemy into thine hand. Now therefore let me smite him, I pray, with the spear even to the earth at once, and I will not smite him the second time." And David said to Abishai, "Destroy him not, for who can stretch forth his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" And here I point out, is David true to character? He went against the appearance of things and was guided by something deeper, something bigger than the moment and the opportunity right before his eyes. And this is where we learn that our convictions need to be stronger than our opportunities. Our convictions must override those temptations that will present themselves to us. And you will have many occasions to sin. Maybe not with some sleeping king before you with his spear in your hand. But the temptations of this world and the opportunities to do the wrong thing may even present itself to you this week. And you might have a decision to make there on the spot. And if your convictions are not already made up and firm and fixed, every likelihood is that you're going to make the wrong decision and do the very thing that will grieve God and will harm your testimony. So what were those things that were controlling David? What was it that held him back from seeking revenge against King Saul at these opportunities? And they seem to stare us in the eyes here. Well, if you look at verse 9, David was acknowledging God-given authority. He said to Abishai, "Destroy him not, for who can stretch forth his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" This was the bridle that restrained David from the plot to kill Saul in his sleep. Up to now, David was on the defensive. Every time Saul made a move to try and corner him, he darted off. He got out of the situation. He got away. But on this night, it was he and Abishai that went in under the cover of darkness, entered into the camp, and right there, when God put them all asleep, it was this principle that controlled his thinking and his actions. God gives authority. And it was vested in Saul by anointing. He was king. He was still alive. He was still operating as king in the land, for better or worse. And David was checked from any passion of revenge or seeking his blood, controlled by this principle. God is a God of order that ordains leaders. It's God that lifts up and God that pulls down. Now, the New Testament guidance on this for us is Romans chapter 13. And when you read the first verses of this chapter, you will see that this is the principle that must rule our hearts and lives as we serve God in this world, where at times we may be tempted to throw off order that is over us. Romans 13, verse 1, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God." And so if you are in the situation that David was in, and you have an opportunity to oppose or depose someone in authority, are you going to take that upon yourself? Are you going to take the law into your own hands and do it your way? Or are you going to bid God's time? "And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid. For he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Wherefore ye must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to him tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor." And you will see that it is not enough to say, These leaders don't deserve to be respected. They're corrupt. They don't follow true paths and principles. Well, we know that Saul didn't. Saul was seeking David, who was truly innocent, did not deserve to be hunted and murdered, and he was the one that was anointed to be future king. And Saul was no perfect leader of Israel, certainly not to David. And yet David had to recognize that he was the Lord's anointed, and God gave him that position, and God gave him that authority. Now, when Paul wrote that epistle to the Romans, chapter 13, under the Roman emperor and within the Roman Empire, government was by no means pure. It was corrupt. It was a cruel, man-crushing machine. And yet Christians were called upon in the New Testament to give loyalty, submission, tribute to whom tribute, honor to whom honor, and to live out the Christian life, recognizing that the powers that be are ordained of God. Now, what is the alternative? What's the alternative to giving due honor to those that are in authority? Anarchy. You have a total breakdown of law and order. If we say to people, because you're a Christian and you are now serving God only, and you are serving one whom you recognize as king, and there's no other authority over you, that only encourages disarray within the very country in which we live. And where religion teaches defiance against proper authority, you're going to have political dysfunction and mayhem. And you will observe this, no doubt, in many parts of the world. What about a missionary that goes to a country, maybe a third world country or a communist country? If God calls you to a communist country and opens the door to go there to be a missionary to preach the gospel, what's going to be your attitude to the government of the day? You might recognize it as totally against what is proper, true government. But your great commission is to go and preach the gospel. And the same recognition of authority is to be given whatever country you might be in. If you're in Russia, you fly the Russian flag. If you're in China, you fly the China flag. And you give due honor to the powers that be. Here in Canada, we have, certainly in the moral realm in our country, we have laws that are being made that are against Christianity. What are we going to do? Not pay our taxes? Are we going to revolt against the government of the day? The Bible tells us we are to recognize that authority that is over us. And this trickles down. It comes to from federal government, local government, and it comes right to the workplace. In Ephesians chapter 6, Paul wrote to those that were servants or slaves that they were to honor masters or their owners and give them due respect and honor. They were not saying, well, I'm now a Christian, I don't listen to those that claim to have that kind of authority over me. And so he had a word for servants, he had a word for masters, he had a word for parents, fathers, and children to obey your mother and father that are over you in the Lord. And that respect, that authority, trickles from government right down to the home. And if there were teenagers here tonight, I would have to say to them, you don't have a perfect mom and dad. None of us did. Parents may be like Saul and be rash and make the wrong decision sometimes. And they may irk you in certain aspects of life. But if you profess to be a Christian, it's your God-given responsibility to give due honor and submit to that authority. because that's one of the greatest gifts God has given you, our parents, to rule, guide, and watch over you. And it is by your submission to God-given authority that you show your faith, you show your Christianity, and you prove your testimony. And that will apply at work. It will apply in whatever community environment you interact. And it comes into the church life as well. If you're a rebel to everything, you will blow your testimony to the cause of Christ and for the work of God. So David, while he had that spear in hand, was restrained by the truth that God alone gives authority. David did not have that. The second thing that David was acting as under God's watchful eye. I pick this up in verse 24, and it says, "Behold, as thy life was much set by this day in mine eyes, so let my life be much set by in the eyes of the Lord." And David no doubt dealt in the principle that as God sees me act, he's going to deal with me. We think in the Lord's Prayer, "Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors." You can't get on your knees and pray for forgiveness if you've got a hardened heart to those that seek your forgiveness. And here is a principle for the Christian to live by. We're to live as the eye of the Lord watching over us at all times. We know that there is nothing hidden from him. There is nothing that God does not see nor observe. And we do nothing that you would not do as if the Lord was right there standing beside you. It's like that I constantly watching you. I read of a prisoner who was in a prison cell, and it drove him berserk that his jail wardens were constantly spying on him through that little open, half circular opening on the door. And he could see the eyeball peering upon him. It was excruciating to his, not only his sense of peace and privacy, but just that every action was being monitored. This week I was in a building and I saw this little glass ball, and I recognized it as one of those 360 camera eyes. And wherever you walk, wherever you move, the camera can pick you up. And just maybe there's somebody somewhere sitting at a TV monitor watching your steps as you walk by. It makes you walk with caution. And then, of course, we need to realize that the eye of the Lord is upon us at all times. There's a verse in 2 Corinthians 16 that says, "For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout all the earth, to show himself strong on behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward him." What a way to live. And while David was in Saul's camp under darkness with all the army sound asleep, he could have done what he pleased. But David acted as if God was watching him at all times. It was Hagar who cried out to God, "Thou God that seest me." Even in the wilderness, in a desert, God saw her. 22 times in the Bible, reference is made to the eyes of the Lord. And one of the strongest is in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 12, where it says, "For the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears are open unto their prayers." And that's the point. If we're going to live godly, if we're going to live in fellowship with God and have his blessing, then we've got to realize that he knows our every action and our every deed. How are you going to get on your knees and pray if you've been living any way you like, it won't work. If you're going to be a man of prayer, if you're going to be a woman of prayer, you need to live with the eye of the Lord upon you at all times. Do you know the Psalm 139? I had thought tonight about reading it, but I want to reserve another psalm for later in the meeting. I want you sometime to read Psalm 139, and I tell you, it will scare you that God knows our sitting down, our rising up, but he knows our thoughts, our thoughts. That's the searching eye of God right into your heart. And he knows the very intent of your heart. And of course, that's what the Bible is. The Bible will search your heart because it's written by the Spirit of God. And if you want to know you're standing before God, this Bible will convict you and convince you. Now, there's a third way by which David was controlled. And he was waiting patiently for the Lord's will to be done. Now, I go back to verse 10. And this is David saying, furthermore, as the Lord liveth, the Lord shall smite him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall descend into battle and perish. Now, David was very much a prophet in saying that, because you know the end of Saul, how the Philistines closed in, and Saul was entrapped, and because he was encircled by the Philistines and soon to die, he fell upon his own sword. He ended his own life. God dealt with him. But David's theology of patience, waiting for the Lord to do it, is to be noted here. And a believer in God must wait God's time, which will be God's way. Now, I want to turn you to the Psalm 37. Now, I do not believe that Psalm 37 was written in conjunction with this event. It was written when David was an older man. And it still applies to the principle that we do not need to fret or be anxious over the prosperity of the wicked. That's the theme of Psalm 37. We want to read the first verses and see how they apply to this situation. David exercised patience for God to do it. And he says, fret not thyself because of evildoers, neither be thou envious against the workers of iniquity, for they shall soon be cut down like the grass, and wither as the green herb. Trust in the Lord and do good. So shalt thou dwell in the land, and verily thou shalt be fed. Delight thyself also in the Lord, and he shall give thee the desires of thine heart. Commit thy way unto the Lord, trust also in him, and he shall bring it to pass. And he shall bring forth thy righteousness as the light, and thy judgment as the noonday. Rest in the Lord, and wait patiently for him. Fret not thyself because of him who prospereth in his way, because of the man who bringeth wicked devices to pass. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not thyself in any wise to do evil, for evildoers shall be cut off. But those that wait upon the Lord, they shall inherit the earth. For yet a little while, and the wicked shall not be. Yea, thou shalt diligently consider his place, and it shall not be. But the meek shall inherit the earth, and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace. The wicked plotteth against the just, and gnasheth upon him with his teeth. The Lord shall laugh at him, for he seeth that his day is coming. Now, all of that could very well apply to that situation with Saul. Now, if you jump down to verse 23 of Psalm 37, the steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord. You don't have to do wrong to do God's will. You don't have to take God's law into your own hands and do it your own way if you will learn patience to wait on the Lord. And then verse 34, wait on the Lord and keep his way, and he shall exalt thee to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, thou shalt see it. So much of this Psalm 37 applies to what shall we do with the wicked that seem to prosper. They spread themselves like a green bay tree. They're all around us prospering. What shall the godly man do? Wait on the Lord. He shall bring it to pass. Now, it's very often the impatience of a Christian that gets him into trouble. Impatience for power, impatience for position, impatience for money. And we are warned by the Apostle Paul in 1 Timothy, the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Some have turned to gambling. Some have turned to schemes that are gimmicky and brought sorrow upon hardship upon themselves by impatience. Impatience. Paul said, charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God. And maybe there is financial pressure upon you in your life. And there are those shady ways that you might seem to get ahead. Trust in the Lord, not in the schemes of men. There are children who, in a hurry to get their inheritance, have hated their parents and despised them, and sought by one means or another to get their hands on what will there be theirs one day in the providence of God, but by impatience, they become cruel, treat their parents with total disrespect, and bring upon themselves great crime and great evil. God's way is to wait for His time. And if you're a student, you got to wait for that door to open. If you're at work and you're looking for promotion, you do not need to tramp on others to climb the ladder of seeming success. The Lord says this, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you in due time. That could apply to Christian workers, missionaries, God's people in the church. The tendency is, I must. Well, remember the Lord's Prayer. Thy will be done, thy kingdom come. That's probably the hardest prayer of all to pray, that God's will is done in His way, in His time. But if you keep on your knees and pray and do as David did in the hour of temptation, you will be restrained. And just as God put that army to sleep, He was present to control the heart of David. And God honored that. And very soon, as you read through these pages, you'll find that David was crowned king of Israel. Not by his own sword and by blood, but by waiting on the Lord. Let's apply this to the work of the church, the work of the gospel here. We could say, well, the church is not growing fast enough. We must do something else to get people into the church and grow the church. We've got to do something different. We've got to change this and change that, the things that might be offensive. And by that means, we may grow the church faster. But in doing so, we destroy the very testimony and the very doctrine of the gospel. The Lord says to us, wait on the Lord. He will bring it to pass. And if we are using God-honoring means, if we're doing it with pure hearts and humbling ourselves before God, He will exalt in due season. And when is that due season? It may not be till we're in heaven. And I assure you, you will in no wise lose your reward. You will in no wise lose the well done of your Heavenly Father if you do the right thing the right way. and wait on the Lord.